hello everybody. This is Hal.
And this is Melanie.
And we want to welcome you to another episode of Making Biblical Family Life Practical, coming to you now from Lansing, Michigan.
You know, we've done a horrible job getting our podcast up the past couple of weeks.
Well, we have. We've been on the road. This is what we are referring to as our Heartland Marathon Tour, because we're going to be on the road for, what, 8 weekends total?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And like 7 weeks. It's a long time. It's just hard to keep up with things when we're in a different place nearly every night.
That it is. It is true. But we're in a nice hotel here in Lansing because the conference here is the Michigan Home Education Conference, sponsored by INCH, their state homeschool organization, which is the Information Network for Christian Homes.
Okay, Hal. Now, yeah. We said we're going to be away from home for 7 weeks. My mama will kill me if I don't also say there's someone house sitting our house.
Right.
Our house is not empty.
Everything is safe and secure.
Yeah.
But me and Melanie are here on the road in the beautiful Wolverine State for this. Now, it's going to be a three-day event, and so we've got a little bit of extra time. And I wanted to share something from an earlier event, but you wanted to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, so today we're going to actually share part of a session. The other half is going to be next week.
Mm-hmm.
That you did at a men's conference.
This was at the Iron Sharpens Iron conference down in Columbia, South Carolina, several weeks ago. And they asked me to do a session that was based on our book, which is just coming out now. We'll tell you about that in a minute. But the first part of this session, I wanted to talk to the men, mainly men, a few of the younger adult single guys, about the importance of being intentional and preparing your son to be a husband one day.
Oh, you know, I think it's important not just to prepare them to be a husband, but to make sure they understand that being a husband and father is part of the mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is, for most of us, that is part of what God wants us to do in life, part of growing his kingdom on earth, of spreading the gospel. You know, it's not, it's a nice to have, sure, it's a blast to be married.
Yeah.
But it's more than that. It's part of what we're supposed to be doing here.
Yeah. And so let's roll on into that. This is the first half of a session, which was in Columbia, South Carolina, several weeks ago. But we're talking about laying a foundation for the future marriage of your sons. So, gentlemen, I'll just jump right on in here. My name is Hal Young, and I am using my wife's computer. So if there's a delay, blame her. No, I'm going to take responsibility. Okay, I'm in charge of this computer. That's me, obviously. I have, as I mentioned in an earlier session, I've got 8 kids. We have 6 boys, one after another. Boom, 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 boom. And then God gave us 2 little girls at the end, and that's really gotten fun. So, anyway, we have... There's another person involved in this. That's my wife, Melanie. We are co-conspirators in the whole thing. Here's the results of a long-term union. That's what 8 kids look like. We were starting to wonder, well, I wonder what a female Young would look like. It's like all of them are XY chromosomes there. But, okay, eventually we did get some. I said, oh, cool. Yeah, that's neat. It worked out well. So, anyway, let me tell you all a story. For a time, a very short time, as short a time as I could manage it, we lived in California. And over Thanksgiving break, we decided we wanted to drive down to San Diego, kind of see a different part of the state. We were up in the Central Valley, up in Modesto, okay? And so we're driving down on Interstate 5, which is the backbone of the state, and it's a typical holiday kind of drive. You know, it's a sunny afternoon, there's nothing, you know, unusual, a little bit of heavy traffic, but it's all right. So we got down to San Diego, we set up our tent, we were going to do camping, and about the time we were settling down for the night, our oldest son, our only child at the time, decided to throw up all over the tent. So, okay, that kind of kills the camping experience. Let's just go find a motel. We'll just come back and pack everything up and clean up tomorrow. So we decamped, so to speak, off to a motel. And once we got there, now we got a phone, so I called back home to let our folks back in the Carolinas know, hey, this is where we are and everything's fine. But they're gasping when I call them. They said, are you okay? What do you mean, are we okay? Have you seen the news? I said, no, we just got in the hotel. What's going on? Well, we turned on the news, and we found out a lot had gone on. Because, see, in this little town called Coalinga, a little town just in the valley somewhere, we had driven through just before noon, and everything was fine. About 2 hours later, the wind picked up. Now, this was during a high drought period. The fields were just as dry as a bone. And they got like 60-mile-an-hour steady straight-line winds for a time. And it was picking up all of that dust off the fields on either side of the road and blowing it across the interstate. Pretty soon they had blackout conditions, and the accidents started. At the end of it, over 114 vehicles piled up in a 2-mile stretch of interstate, and 17 people died, and it was incredible. And so, you know, if you had been in the hotel lobby the next day and you had asked me, well, what was I-5 like, not knowing the news, I said, it's a typical day. Typical, disgustingly beautiful California weather, a little bit of traffic, nothing unusual, okay? You've seen it all before. If you'd asked somebody that drove about 2 hours behind me, who would have said, it was like hell on earth. You would not have believed it. He said, I couldn't see a thing. And we were sandwiched between two trucks, and I managed to climb out of a broken window and rescue my family. And we're dodging traffic to get to the side of the road, and you can hear the collisions back in the line and breaking glass, and things are starting to burn, and people are screaming, and it was just awful. It was incredible. You would not believe what we went through. You know, the point of that is conditions change. And when I went through that part of the road, when I was a teenager, when I was a young single 20-something guy, I dealt with the kind of temptations and troubles that my dad had, that my grandfather had. Probably my great-grandfather had very similar temptations he had to deal with. And we had the same kind of fight on our hands. But since that time, let me kind of give you a picture. I can tell you very distinctly this date because I've marked it in my head. In 1997, okay, so we're talking 20 years ago, I was sitting in a conference with my wife, and we had one of our little babies. He was, I don't know, about 6 months old at the time, so he got to come to the conference with mom and dad. We're sitting there listening to a pastor from New York speaking, and he said, by the way, just in the flow of conversation, said, by the way, we're going to have gay marriage in this country because the church has given up the high ground. We can no longer fight this on moral territory. And my wife and I looked at each other, and we thought, man, that's radical. That's like crazy talk. I mean, who ever heard of such a thing? But he was very definite about it. Well, when that little boy was in high school, over 30 states had a constitutional amendment that defined marriage as between a man and a woman. They had amended the state constitutions in the majority of states in this country. By the time that high schooler was a freshman in college, the Supreme Court had said, away with all that. We're totally going to redefine marriage. We're going to turn however many thousands of years up on their ears, and we're going to set out on our own course. And by the way, gay marriage, that's so last year. We're going to redefine what it means to be male or female, or if that's permanent, or if you can change it at will, or something else. And you know what? The culture's changed. The roadway has changed. It may look like the same road, but if you're not aware of it, and if you're not looking back there to see what your sons, what your grandsons are going through, you're not going to be able to counsel them as effectively and prepare them for the battle that they actually have. Now, that's the bad news part. Let's talk about something a little more cheerful for a little bit. Let's talk about love, okay? This session is called Love, Honor, and Virtue. All right, so let's talk about love first. One of the things in the community that we work with a lot that people talk about is, what's a biblical standard for finding a wife, okay? Now, it's always good to ask, what does the Bible say about a topic? And some things are very definite. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You know, thou shalt not murder. Those kind of things are real easy to find. But, you know, what about finding a wife? How do I go about doing that biblically? So my wife and I did a little bit of research, and I want to share some of the fruits of what we found. These are biblically approved ways to find a wife, okay? So you just take these, and you can take notes, you young guys. You might want to keep these in mind. Okay, number one, wait for God to create one. Okay, Genesis chapter 2 says that's how Adam met his wife. God made a new one. Okay, and so that is an option. We haven't seen that duplicated, but it, you know, who knows? Number two, what Abraham did when Isaac was of marriageable age was he got his senior steward and sent him to a far country and said, "Go visit with my family and find a mate for my son. Find a wife." So let your dad send one of his employees to go choose you a wife from your kinfolk. That's an option. Genesis 24 gives us approval on that. Or you can get a job with your uncle and then marry your cousin. Okay? Now, I come from mountain stock, okay? I come from the mountain folk, okay? And let me tell you, my family tree is so twisted up, I am my own fifth cousin. I can document this, all right? So I mean, cousins, okay, that's fine. Don't talk to me about cousins. That is an option. Any former military guys? How about win the battle and get a wife as a prize for your courage on the battlefield? That's what happened when the elderly Caleb was going into the promised land, and he looked at a certain village and said, "The man who takes this city can have my oldest daughter as wife." And I'm sure he already knew who Othniel had his eyeball on, and Othniel took the city. He said, "If I get the girl, I'm going to take the town." Okay, so they did. Likewise, you can choose one from the captives to come back. Or now, this is my personal favorite, okay? If you look in Judges chapter 21, we have an example which any of our churches could put into place like immediately, okay? And that is that you take your marriageable guys and you hide them out in the corners during a festival, and then they kidnap somebody from the worship team. And then Judges 21. And see, the elders are supposed to smooth that out with the parents, you know, afterwards, okay? So, you know, something we saw when we looked at all of this kind of stuff is, and you look at, there's all kinds of relationships in Scripture that they don't even tell you how these couples got together. And, you know, when God wants us to do something specifically, He's usually pretty specific about it. And what I kind of see looking at all of this stuff is that your culture matters, your community matters. There's a lot of different ways to meet and to find a wife or a mate. But, you know, you got to give grace. And you got to recognize, I don't recommend most of these for the 21st century American culture. They don't really work, generally speaking. I mean, we had one... I'll tell you another story later. Hold on. Anyway, the thing is, here's a point I wanted to make. There's a bunch of different ways you can find a mate, but more important than the way you find one is how you prepared yourself. Are you prepared to be a husband for that wife when she shows up? Now, you know, little girls are famous for when they're very small, they start picking out their wedding dress, and they've got the whole wedding planned out, and there's just like a dotted line, an outline of a human figure that, insert groom here. One day I'll have a groom, and I'll put him here, and then I'll get to wear the dress. And, you know, girls do that. Well, we guys can do that too, okay? But we need to plan for more than the honeymoon. We need to plan, well, how am I going to actually love a wife? How am I really going to be a leader in a home? What's it going to be like to be a father one day? Ooh, it's going to all come back in my head, isn't it? Yeah, it is. Okay, it's more important how you're preparing than how you find her. Now let's talk a little bit about a biblical standard for love like this, okay? Love has a bunch of different forms. Now, some of my family tree, if you go back way back in the 1600s, they were from like Puritan New England, okay? And I found some Puritan Valentine cards online. I thought this was really awesome, okay? So here's one. That you come up, he's got like this little drawing of a little Puritan maiden, and it says, "I need you," which I think, okay, that's typical Valentine type of language. But the Puritans had their own approach to things, their own sort of look on it. And so she says, "I need you to help raise livestock and crops, or surely we will starve to death come winter." Yeah, okay, that just gets the heart beating, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, but you know what? You think about it, look at the story of the pilgrims. Half their community died the first winter. And so you got a lot of widows there with little kids, and you got a lot of widowers with little kids. And I'm sure they looked at each other and said, you know what? I may not be your dream boat, but we need each other real bad. And so, you know, that can be a valid thing. But let's talk a little bit about more typical situations. There's a really great book by C.S. Lewis called The Four Loves. I really highly recommend it. And he talks about the way that love is portrayed in ancient Greek, particularly in the biblical Greek. And there's three terms that you see that, you know, we can understand this, and we all call them love in English, right? Number one, eros, of course, that's where the term erotic comes from. That's romantic love or sexual love. It's very definite what that means. Then there's phileos, which is the friendship, affection, like. It's a little better than Facebook love, but it's, you know, it's a lower, you know, less sexual type of thing. Agape, that's the Christian ideal, right? The self-sacrificing love. The love of Christ for his people, the love of Christians for one another. Okay. And these are all valid, and they're all part of a good functioning marital relationship, okay? And so recognize that they all are there. And you can't, you know, you can't say, well, you know, it's all about the bedroom. Well, no, it's not, actually. Well, it's all about this holy, exalted, you know, very pious type of sacrificial life. Well, that's got to be there, but all of it's supposed to be there, okay? So how do you go about loving a wife? This is an important thing, guys. How do you learn to love your wife? Let me give you three little easy things here, okay? We find, for example, in Genesis 2:18 is where we see the institution of marriage come about. God looked at Adam. It's really cool now. Think about, read through the creation account, and you see how God created the heavens and the earth, and he created the seas and the dry land, and he created the plants, and he created the animals, and it all along the way, it stops at each evening time, and it says, and behold, it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And then it gets to, he creates Adam on the sixth day, and it's the first time God says, and it's not good. Now think about that. It said God looks at Adam and he said, it is not good that the man should be alone. Okay? And that's interesting because when you think about this, Adam had no sin at that point. There was nothing separating him from fellowship with God. He lived in perfect surroundings. He just pulled the fruit off the trees. He didn't have to wear clothing because it was beautiful and nobody was going to see him anyway because he's the only person on earth. And it's just, and he's got, the whole zoo is his like pets. It's like his kennel. He can go out and play with the tigers if he wants. I mean, wouldn't you love to get out there at riverbanks and just play with the tigers or something? Well, not now, but at that time you could. And God looks at him and says, that's not enough. That's not good for you to be here with all of this stuff, and you don't have a mate. You don't have a wife that corresponds to you. You need a helper. And any of our wives can look at us and say, oh boy, did he ever need help. Yes, we need it continually. And so that's a foundational thing that God created marriage in part because we're not meant to be isolated little atomic particles out here. We are meant to be in community with one another, with our mate, okay? And 1 Timothy 5:2, Paul is talking to young Timothy, and he's telling him, look, you know, here's how you treat the people in your church. You know, you treat the older men as fathers and the older women as mothers. And what does he say about the young women? He says you should treat the younger women as sisters in all purity. And, you know, that means they don't have cooties. Your sister doesn't have cooties. You can be friends. You can go out for coffee with a girl or something. And it doesn't mean anything more than we are friends. Well, if you could do that with the girl that you eventually marry, can't you do it with the girl that you did marry? Yeah, you ought to. You need to befriend your wife. She needs to be your best friend. You need to work on that if she's not already. You need to listen to your wife. Like the brother said this morning, you know, it's really important. Your wife wants to be heard. She wants you to understand her. In 1 Peter 3:7, she's entitled to that because Peter said, husbands, you are to live with your wives in an understanding way. And we don't understand that by cutting them off in mid-sentence and fixing their problem for them. We need to feel their pain, so to speak. We need to understand them and let them unload on us without us answering, without us defending, without us arguing, just to say, I want to understand. Just let me know. Just tell me and let me process all of this, hon. Okay, so we need to learn to listen. We don't do that real well, guys. We need to serve our wives. You know, in Ephesians 5:25, when Paul is talking about marriage, you know, he says, oh, that wonderful verse where he says that wives, submit to your husbands as unto the Lord. And all those guys says, yes, I'll be in charge just like the Bible tells me to. But if you go on to the next verse and it says, and husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Okay? And brothers, I will tell you this. We will all rise to the challenge when we have to step in front of the bullet. When we have to go confront the bear on the trail or do whatever. We got to be heroic for our wives. We'll be heroic. The love that lays down our lives for our wives is when we get out of our warm bed to say, yes, dear, I'll go check and make sure that noise wasn't a burglar. I know it's the third time. I know I haven't heard it at all, but I love you enough, I will go and I'll check it. Because let me tell you, most Christians are not torn apart by lions in the Colosseum. Most Christians are killed by pecking of chickens, okay? You gotta control the chickens. You gotta live down the chickens, and that means we gotta serve our wives and get outside of our own comfort. You know, speaking of Paul, we all hear 1 Corinthians 13 talked about as the chapter about love, and it is. And sometimes, frankly, these familiar passages that are so good, we kind of go to sleep when people start reading them. Yeah, I've heard that. But I was reading that one day, and it occurred to me, why is Paul listing all this stuff? Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way, and it goes on down that list. And I thought, you know, Paul is not saying, he's not putting his arm around the brothers there in Corinth and saying, you guys are so awesome. You're so wonderful at this. You're so patient and kind, and you're so self-sacrificing and everything, and I just want to put rainbows around you. You guys are just so wonderful. I think what Paul is saying is, love is patient and kind, and you guys are not, okay? And I want you to think about that. Are you patient and kind today, or are you insisting on your own way, being arrogant and rude? That's what we normally do, okay? We have bad days. We lose our temper. We do boast. We guys are irritable and resentful. And I think Paul is saying, love is doing something different than you naturally do. Okay? You have to learn this. You have to think about this. You have to feel this welling up in you to say, ooh, I got her now. Oh, I can win this argument. No, I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to be rude and impatient. I'm going to show love and patience to my wife, even if I think she's wrong. That's what real love is. Okay? That's what we need to be working on. Love bears all things, okay? And it never ends. It does not fail. It doesn't quit and give up and run away. So that's really important. You need to think about that when you think about loving a wife or showing love to anybody, really. Now, here's another thing. We encounter something that is, I find a little hard to understand. See, I got married right out of college. I met my girlfriend in college, and we were just friends, like literally just friends, for several years. And we realized, wait, this might be something bigger. And we went through a very deliberate process. But we married when we were 22, and you know, right out of college, and I was going into the Air Force, and so I knew what my immediate income future looked like, and so everything was in good shape for that. But I see an awful lot of people that are delaying marriage like indefinitely. Like, why? Why? You know, somebody, one of the professors up at Liberty wrote an article for Atlantic Monthly, of all things, talking about marriage. And she said, one thing that she is seeing is an awful lot of the younger generation, sorry guys, a lot of the younger generation sees marriage as a capstone. They say, well, I want to, you know, finish college, and I want to pay off my student loans, and I want to get my car paid for, and my 401k is all paid up, and I'm invested in my pension plan, and I got some adventure travel to do, and then I'll settle down. And that'll be my crowning achievement, is to go out and get the girl and get married then. I said, instead of a capstone, why don't we think of it as a cornerstone? Why don't we think of it as, we are going to start off, we're going to lay a foundation, and we'll build on it together. That is so cool, you know. I've seen people who got married for one reason or another, and they couldn't, you know, it wasn't really their choice, but they weren't able to get married until their mid-30s. And it's a hard transition, because when you've been out on your own for 12 or 13 years, you're kind of, you have a way of doing things. Now suddenly you're merging with somebody else who has a way of doing things. Wouldn't it be so much easier if you could start earlier and to build that up together? And this is something that I found helpful in thinking about it. Sometimes we look at marriage and say, well, that's nice. That's an optional thing. You know, I'll consider it one day. But what if marriage is part of your mission here on earth? That's a thought. And that's a pretty radical thought. And I think we as guys can really understand this idea. You know, God said from the very beginning that we need a helper. And it's interesting that, you know, he gave Adam work to do before he gave Adam a wife. He gave him, you know, he's tending the garden, he's naming the animals, he's doing, you know, he's doing things like that. And then he says, you need a helper, and he brings Eve to him, but I see no story about Eve working in the garden. I see no story about Eve naming the animals. I think that the help that she is providing is for a larger mission. And we guys tend to define ourselves by our jobs. You know, we look at our jobs and say, this is my job title, this is my position in the hierarchy in the corporate world or the organizational tree or whatever. And we think, well, you know, that's who I am. And one day, maybe I'll get the golden handshake and I can retire early and go do, you know, entertain myself until I die. But, you know, our mission in life is a whole lot bigger than the job that we do every day to put food on the table. And I think that's what God intends here, that I couldn't take, when I'm working in a paper mill as an engineer, my wife is a biologist. They don't need a biologist to work on the paper machine. So I can't take her in, and she can't help me at the paper mill, but she helps me in the larger mission. And the paper mill was just something that I did to pay bills, okay? And I had to look at things a little differently when I realized that. And by the way, I keep mentioning the passages in Genesis. No apologies for that, because when Jesus was asked about marriage, when Paul was asked about marriage, they both went back to Genesis 1 and 2. And they didn't say, this is an analogy. Understand the old story about... No, he just said, this is a historical fact, and you need to learn from it. So that's fine. If it's good enough for Jesus and Paul, it's good enough for little me. Speaking of creation, John Murray, he's a Presbyterian theologian. He's passed on now. But he said, if you look at the account in Genesis, you see a lot of things that God established before the fall of man. And these are significant. And he calls them creation mandates. He counted, I think, about 7 total. But the things like work is not a punishment. Work is not a result of the fall. Now, the fact that our work is unpleasant or painful or unprofitable, that's a result of the fall. But God gave Adam work to do. You know, having dominion over the earth is a human calling. That's a mandate that we have that predates the fall of man. And the role of companionship in marriage between a man and a woman, That is something that God established before there was sin in the world. And by the way, after all of that, God says, and it was very good. Not just good, but very good. And you know what? The very first commandment that's recorded in Scripture, the first commandment to mankind, is God's commandment to that young couple. It says, go forth and be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Okay? God established our sexual nature in the Garden of Eden before there was sin. Now, we've done everything we can to goof it up since then, but in its original design, it's pure and holy and what God intended. And so, when God establishes the church in the New Testament, what does he say about elders? What does he say about deacons? They're to be husbands of one wife. You know? Now, does that mean that people who aren't married can't be church leaders? I don't think so, but I think that the standard there is that a person who's functioning in the full model of a family life has a certain empathy for other people who have struggles in family life, and I think that's what the intention is. But I think that's a very interesting point that God values that so highly, is to say elders should be husbands of one wife, deacons should be husbands of a wife. And so, you know, when Paul talks about singleness, best we understand, Paul was probably a widower because he had been on the Sanhedrin before he became a Christian, and you had to be married to be part of the Jewish Sanhedrin. So obviously at that time he'd been married. He never mentions a wife once he becomes a believer, and so we think that he was probably a widower at a fairly young age. And as a single guy, he knew that he was totally free to follow wherever God led him. You know, he could go into hostile territory, he could be shipwrecked, he could be thrown into jail and beaten, and he'd never have to worry about who's taking care of my wife? Who's going to provide for my children? He never had any of that hesitation that would naturally come to a married man. And so the people in Corinth were asking, well, should we pursue this ideal of singleness and celibacy and such like that? And Paul says, well, it's good if you can be like I am. And if you're single for a time, if you're single, make the most of it. That's the time when you can do incredible things, when you don't have other responsibilities and burdens that hold you back. But Paul continues that discussion. He says, however, because of immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Okay? And that's one of those things. The purposes of marriage, you see the companionship, the mutual help that you see in Genesis. You see that commandment to fill the earth and subdue it. And that's all part of the original purpose of marriage. And then after the fall, you see this in 1 Corinthians 7. Paul says, you know what, your marriage is meant to be a channel to put all of that energy and all of that desire and that sexual urge needs to be channeled right through your marriage. And that's one of the reasons you ought to be married. It's better to be married than to burn with passion. That's what he says later in the chapter. Okay, well, next week we'll have the second half of that message. We'll be talking about another aspect of preparing your son for a future adulthood in the married or the faithful celibate single state.
Yeah, teaching him that he who finds a wife finds a good thing.
That's right. But we want to talk to you about our book, which is just now coming out. It's written for guys in the teens and the 20s, for single guys to talk about a biblical view of sexuality.
Yeah, it helps them to get an idea of, it doesn't just tell them the biology, that's important, but more than that, you've got to have it in biblical context. This puts it in biblical context. It tells them how to fight temptation, how to recover if they've fallen, mm-hmm. and how to have healthy relationships with girls.
So this book is called Love, Honor, and Virtue, and the subtitle is Gaining or Regaining a Biblical Attitude Toward Sexuality.
You can find it on our website, RaisingRealMen.com.
Mm-hmm. So we want to encourage you, go out and look at that. If you've got a young man in your life, or if you are a young man yourself, a young single guy, want some encouragement, want either a pat on the back or a kick in the seat to walk that straight and narrow line with integrity, this book is written for you, and it's an easy read. It's less than 100 pages.
Okay, I'm laughing, Hal, because this past weekend in Sioux Falls, a mom said, well, how do I get my son to read it? And I looked at her and I said, just set it on his table and say, it's about sex, and walk off.
Okay. Well, all right. And it is. That truly is, but it's all biblical context, and I think you'll find it's a very good, useful tool to have some really good discussions with your young people or to encourage you to go into the scriptures yourself. Again, go to our website, RaisingRealMen.com, and just search on Love, Honor, and Virtue, and you'll find it there. Well, look, we're going to have the second half next week, and so coming to you from Lansing, Michigan, once again, making biblical family life practical wherever we can, I'm Hal.
And I'm Melanie.
Thanks so much for listening.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Making Biblical Family Life Practical with Hal and Melanie Young. If you found this program interesting, challenging, and encouraging, why not join us on the web at halandmelanie.com. That's HalandMelanie.com. Or follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook/HalandMelanie or Facebook.com/RaisingRealMen. This program is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. Join us next week when we'll be back to talk about making biblical family life practical. Until then, thank you and God bless you for listening.